Today on Straight Talk Africa, the tragic story of Alfred Olango, a 38-year-old Ugandan refugee. He was shot and killed by U.S. police in September 2016 while responding to a call for emergency psychiatric help. Olango's death was among several captured on video near when anger over U.S. police shootings, particularly of black men, rose to new heights. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Sheka Sali. Today, it's a discussion on alleged U.S. police brutality. The death of 38-year-old Alfred Olango at the hands of California police in 2016 attracted international attention, not only to the issue of race, but how police react to people that may have psychiatric problems. The incident was one of nearly 1,000 police shooting fatalities in the United States in 2016. VOA and our partner NBS Television in Kampala teamed up to examine what happened and whether the shooting could have been prevented.
September 2016, a black man, a Ugandan refugee, gunned down by police in the city of El Cajon in Southern California.
The police did it again, y'all. They shot another unarmed black person.
At 3:45 p.m., Alfred Olango was pronounced dead. Protesters swam the streets of El Cajon, condemning yet another in a string of police shootings that divided the United States.
Black lives matter!
All lives matter!
All lives matter!
Alfred!
Olango!
Alfred!
Olango!
Black, white, brown, all demanding justice in Alfred Olango's death. But 3 months later, the local prosecutor clears the officer. The lethal shots were reasonable, she said, fired in self-defense. To his devastated family, Ugandan refugees who came to the United States more than 20 years ago, Alfred Olango's death was an incalculable loss.
We have come from a war zone. We wanted protection. That's why we're here.
How did a 38-year-old Ugandan become a casualty in America's conflict over race and police violence? Was the shooting necessary? Or, as his family says in court, an abuse of Alfred Olango's civil rights? I traveled nearly 10,000 miles from Kampala to investigate the death of Alfred Olango. With my reporting partner Paul Ndiho from The Voice of America, we discovered new evidence about how the police handled Olango's case and a fateful decision, one that may have made the difference between life and death. San Diego, a jewel on the Pacific coast of Southern California, a major urban area of 1.4 million people. It is a tranquil city known for its laid-back vibe and diversity. But it has not escaped the rush of fatal police shootings across the United States. At least 963 people were shot and killed by law enforcement in 2016. That is an average of more than two a day, according to the Washington Post. The count includes 138 in the state of California and 8 in San Diego County. None caused more outrage than Alfred Olango's.
We are here today to address the killing of another unarmed black man in this country, Alfred Olango.
The city of El Cajon in suburban San Diego has been a welcoming place for African immigrants. Like many places in the United States, it is a community struggling with crime, gangs, and illegal drugs. Videos of Alfred Olango's violent last moments flashed across the news and the social media. Olango seen walking strangely, officers approaching, one with a gun, another with a taser, then a sudden move.
And from the available video footage, this particular location was where Olango was standing, right there, where you see Paul there.
Fatal police shootings of blacks are a running controversy in the United States, sparking nationwide protests and debate. But police have been targets too. 63 died from gunfire in 2016. In the month before the Olango shooting, 5 police officers were killed in the city of Dallas, Texas, when a black gunman targeted them during a protest over police shootings. Americans are polarized, some backing police, others condemning them. But the issue is not so clear-cut. One big reason is that a quarter of those shot by police have a psychiatric illness or mental distress. Michael Biasotti is a retired police chief. He currently works as a consultant on issues of law enforcement and mental illness.
Every police officer deals with this issue almost on a daily basis. It's a very large percentage of police calls. Things like crisis intervention training or de-escalation training should be a part of a basic police academy when you come into law enforcement so that it becomes a part of the profession. It changes the culture of the profession.
Alfred Olango did not have a mental illness, his family members say. But days before he died, an event happened that threw him into emotional crisis, and it caused Alfred to act in ways that put him and others in mortal danger. Lukutu Village, northern Uganda, birthplace of Alfred Olango in 1978. Alfred was a middle child among 9 in the family. On Facebook, his father, Richard Olango Abuka, said he served with the Uganda National Liberation Army before being exiled to Kenya. The family spent time in a refugee camp before being let into the United States in 1991 and settling near San Diego. Soon after, Richard was honored by President George Bush Sr. for helping other refugees get jobs. Walter Lam is founder of a non-profit organization that helps refugees resettle in the San Diego area.
Normally when I see the refugees coming down the escalators, I can tell whether this is going to be a successful case or will be a burden. And when I saw the Olango, I celebrated. This is a family that looks unified. They are all together and on and on.
He knew Olango well.
Welcomed them to San Diego and as part of the Ugandan community. And this young man also was good friends of my children. They played soccer together. And their father, Mr. Richard Olango, was the coach, coaching these children in football.
Alfred kept close to his family. He was seen as a protector who liked to bring everyone together. Lucy Olango was at the scene when her brother was shot. Lucy is the elder sister of Alfred Olango.
We do really miss Alfred because he was the light of our family. Even if he was in the middle. I know I'm older than him, but he would do anything, stand to protect me.
Apollo Olango, brother of Alfred Olango.
Alfred was someone that would always make sure you're fine. He's given a shirt to a homeless person while we were just walking down the street in San Diego. Okay. Apparently he had an extra one in his car.
The Olango children went to a Catholic school, then to San Diego High. But growing up in an adopted country wasn't always smooth. Alfred tumbled into a string of run-ins with the law. At age 17, convicted for taking a car without consent. At 20, a felony for receiving stolen property. 2 driving under the influence convictions followed. And in 2001, another for selling drugs. Then, one night in 2005, police in the state of Colorado stopped his car for tinted windows. They found a small amount of illegal drugs and a handgun. Alfred spent 3 years in prison. Alfred's brother, Apple Olango, said that in time, Alfred chose a new path.
All I can say in that particular situation, when you come to a new country, sometimes it's difficult learning the ropes. But I believe that he put himself on a straight and narrow track eventually and started walking a direct line.
Lam also knew a different side of Alfred.
This was a very, very, very helpful young man. I remember just before his death, there was another funeral of a Ugandan that died in here. Huh? This is a man that went out of his way, because some Ugandans and Africans in here did not have transport, they don't have transportation. He provided transportation, bringing people to the funeral and all that.
Alfred was a professional cook. He dreamt of opening his own restaurant one day.
African cuisine, mixed American, whatever, because he's been working in American restaurants, of course, but he also knows how to cook African food. So usually would come to my house also and like, show me how to cook this, you know, this and that. And he was one of the best cook as well, but I beat him in cooking so far, but mom taught all of us and all of them know how to cook, so which is good. It didn't matter whether it's a boy or a girl, so taught everybody.
Alfred had separated from his wife. He had several children and relished spending time with them.
Alfred had children, beautiful young daughter, Sheree. He had a few other daughters as well. And they're wonderful kids. He loved the family life. I think that that's what he really wanted.
In the month before the shooting, Alfred seemed fine. He returned to San Diego from Phoenix, Arizona, where he worked for a time at a suburban steakhouse. Alfred missed his family and another important person in his life, a fellow refugee. Barricade Demez, an Ethiopian, had been Alfred Olango's closest friend since elementary school.
Barricade was actually he was a great friend to the entire community, a young man, Ethiopian. He actually was involved in an assault where he became paraplegic and lost the use of his limbs below his waist. And life had become very difficult for him.
Alfred's best friend had problems. A friend of Barricade's, Jamal Mohammed, said Barricade was in turmoil over his health and a relationship.
He was a guy who was very active. And all of a sudden, he transitions into being in a wheelchair. It hits him hard.
He was a regular around Alfred's family.
He had hung out with his friend Barricade and even took him and drove and went to my mom's place and they hung out together and things like that. And he dropped Barricade, I don't know exact what day, back to his place. And then Barricade committed suicide and he was just so devastated. They were so close.
That affected him in a very, very negative way. I called him, I asked him what's going on with Barricade. He said, Apollo, he's gone. And I could hear that it really hurt him.
The two made plans to meet.
I was actually on my way to Uganda. I was going to be heading back to visit some family and whatnot. And he said, Apollo, I could use some gas money. So I sent him some money to Western Union. And a few hours later, my phone just starts ringing out of control. What's going on in the news? What's going on in the news? Is that Lucy in the news? What's going on? And all I know is that I sent him money to come pick me up so we can go to the airport the next day. We're going to spend some time together and go over exactly what went on so I could just be there for him. That's really what I wanted to do. But he never made it.
Breaking news.
Angry crowds growing as we work to figure out why El Cajon police were forced to shoot a black man.
Live there with reaction from witnesses to the shooting.
The police killing of an unarmed black man, Alfred Olango.
On the day of the shooting, Alfred Olango showed up at his sister Lucy's apartment. She woke up to let him in. Alfred was confused and scared. He told her people were after him and that he hadn't slept for 2 days. So, at 12:57 p.m., Lucy called for help. Lucy dialed the 911 emergency number for police. She told the dispatcher that her brother was having a mental breakdown and needed to go to a hospital. And she also informed the dispatcher that he had no weapons. It was a 5150 call, a code that Alfred Olango may have a mental health condition. Lucy stepped away to get ready for her job as an aide at a mental health facility. But when she returned, Alfred was gone. She got into her car. Then she was shocked to see Alfred wandering erratically in and out of traffic. Lucy followed her brother, desperately trying to get him to stop. But Alfred wasn't responding. She called 911 a second time, 47 minutes after her first call.
North Molson at the ARCO, reference to 5150. Subject is BMA 30s, black tank top, blue pants.
The second time when I called for help, when I saw Alfred crossing the street and he was in the middle of the street, nearly got hit by a car, and I was crying on the phone. Why there's nobody, you know, it's been a while since I called and nobody even called to let me know what is going on.
Another 17 minutes passed and still no police. Lucy called 911 a third time, but the dispatch again said all officers were busy. Finally, at 3 minutes past 2 p.m., more than an hour after Lucy's first call, the dispatcher center sent Officer Richard Gonzalez and Josh McDaniel to the scene.
227K, was the RP from the ARCO station like an employee?
No, it's the sister of the subject who's calling.
228, 227, I don't see him on Broadway. Samar, that's the last place you saw him. His first name is Alfred, same last name as the RP.
Lucy saw police cars at the ARCO station. She approached Officer Gonzalez.
I met him and told him, my brother is not armed. He's not doing very well. He's having a mental breakdown. And he needs help. He asked me if my brother was ever diagnosed with mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar, or whatever. I told him, not to my knowledge. And I was done with him, and then he drove and went to the side looking up for Alfred.
Gonzalez drove to a mall across Broadway next to Pancho's restaurant. He spotted Alfred in the parking lot, and so did Lucy. A drive-through camera at Pancho's recorded what happened next. So did one restaurant worker's smartphone. Michael Biasori breaks it down.
He's there now, and I see, and he's walking off the curb. His right hand is in his pocket.
Get your hand out of your pocket. Still non-compliant, still won't get his hand out of his pocket.
The sister is yelling, and she's in this picture now, the same thing. Take your hand out of your pocket, take your, and he's still not complying.
So I'm pleading there, Alfred, please raise your hand, raise your hands. Please don't do stupid stuff. Raise your hands up. He wasn't processing, and the officer continued to say, raise your hands, raise your hands. Of course, made Alfred more agitated.
So we're asking him in a split second to make the judgment. He's gambling with his life that that's not a firearm.
Shots fired. 833 Broadway, rear of the taco shop.
Do you have somebody you could
call? For help, not for you to guys.
Yeah, she's just still in shock. So
the object Alfred Olango pointed at Officer Gonzalez turned out not to be a weapon. It was a vape pipe for electronic smoking. After Lucio Olango's first call for help, El Cajon police took more than an hour to arrive. But only minutes later, Alfred Olango was shot four times. In the aftermath, crowds gathered, some demanding answers. That evening, police provided one. From the cell phone video, they released a still photo they said explained the shooting. El Cajon Police Chief Jeff Davis.
At one point, the male rapidly drew an object from his front pants pocket, placed both hands together on it, and extended it rapidly towards the officer, taking what appeared to be a shooting stance.
Later, an autopsy report said Alfred had trace levels of alcohol and cocaine in his system. The local district attorney investigated the shooting to determine if Gonzalez acted legally. Bonnie Dumenez, San Diego County District Attorney.
After carefully reviewing the facts, the evidence, and the law, we've determined the officer's use of deadly force was reasonable under the circumstances, and he bears no criminal liability for his actions.
The Olango family and their supporters in the community did not see it this way.
That's Mr. Olango.
Reverend Shane Harris leads the local chapter of the National Action Network, a civil rights group.
So I want it to be very clear. We do believe that Alfred Olango was unjustly killed.
Harris says Olango's refugee status has given the issue of the officer-involved shootings international visibility.
One, it deals with an international presence of pressure on America around policing. But two, it deals with clearly the issue of how America deals with mental health and how America deals, how police deal with those who are not harming anybody or hurting anybody but calling for help. One thing is certain on that day, Lucy was not calling for because he was hurting anybody. She was calling for help and assistance. We're hoping that people who come to this country, refugees, are treated with help that they're seeking. They come here seeking peace and protection.
It's been tough. It's been so hard. We are all still grieving, and we'll continue to be grieving the loss of Alfred.
It's hard to describe, man. There are no words to describe the emotional feeling that you go through when something like that happens. And I couldn't stand, I know that. I just had to get on my knees, that was it.
Olango's father, Alfred's estranged wife, and two of his children filed civil rights lawsuits against the city of El Cajon and Gonzalez. Lucy also sued for negligence and emotional distress.
Multiple sources tell us that it's Richard Gonzalez, an officer well known to our Team 10 investigators.
Gonzalez's lawyer did not respond to the questions from NBS and VOA. But before the shooting, his job performance had already come under scrutiny. Gonzalez had been demoted from a desk job to a patrol duty after a female El Cajon police officer accused him of sexual harassment and sued. The city settled her claim for $90,000. Lawyer Dan Gillion represents Lucio Lango.
I have all sorts of problems with Richard Gonzalez leading into the scenario, just from the character of the person that he's demonstrated himself to be. But if he just, even just limiting it to what we see on the video, this is a cowboy. They decides to pull out his gun on somebody who has not committed a crime.
Here in San Diego, there is another way to handle these kinds of calls. A PAT team, that is a special police unit to answer calls involving people with mental problems. PAT stands for Psychiatric Emergency Response Team. A patrol officer and a clinical expert work together to prevent encounters from becoming violent. Mark Marvin oversees the PAT program in San Diego County. The team operates in 11 jurisdictions, including El Cajon.
A 911 call comes in to dispatch. The dispatcher can look at who's out in the field and can basically dispatch a PERT team to that scene when that person is in the midst of a psychiatric crisis.
Bobby Stans helps run an addiction recovery program in San Diego and used to work with Lucio Lango. Her insights about Alfred were both as a sister and mental health care aide.
If you can imagine having done that work for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and then having a family member experiencing a psychiatric crisis and understanding that you need some assistance to de-escalate him because you're unable to do so by yourself, and you call for assistance, you call for help. And imagine the response that she got was nowhere near what she was expecting.
Stan said it was common for a person in mental crisis to mimic someone who frightens them.
Clients in a mental health state, if you posture at them, they raise their level and they posture back because they want to show you, I'm not intimidated by you. In normal circumstances, everyone becomes compliant. Alfred pulled out a vape pipe and pointed them at them.
Alfred in this mental health state postures back. And boom, we have Alfred die.
But did Alfred's breakdown have to get that far? During our reporting, we sent detailed questions and document requests to the city of El Cajon and the district attorney's office. City officials said that the law allowed them to withhold some material. They said that the pending family lawsuits prevent them from discussing the shooting.
But do you think the shooting was justified for Olango?
Well,
you as a police officer.
So you're getting into questions again that I can't get into because of litigation.
But in the response to one of our public records requests, NBS and VOA found something the city had not disclosed before. It was a summary of activity by police dispatchers the day of the shooting, and it revealed a critical decision. A decision that prevented Alfred Olango from getting the kind of help his sister Lucy expected. When Lucy Olango walked into the taco shop parking lot, Officer Gonzalez already had his gun in hand.
Pulling a gun and say, raise your hands up, is not a way you come at a person who is having a mental breakdown. You haven't even engaged with the person. He has not talked to you. You did not find what was wrong. How can I help you? What's going on? Is there something I can do to help you? He didn't do none of those.
Hundreds of police around San Diego have been trained in PAT de-escalation tactics. So have many El Cajon officers, although the city officials would not say whether Gonzalez was one of them. On the day of the shooting, a PAT team was available on duty in El Cajon. Why wasn't it called to the scene? This is what police said then. At the specific time of the incident, that team was on a different radio call that was also PAT-related. They were not immediately available. But that wasn't the whole story. The dispatch records show that, in fact, the PAT team was available for Lucy Olango's call. The team was clear at 1:53 p.m. It was 8 minutes before she called 911 the third time. But for reasons that aren't explained, dispatchers sent the PAT team on a different call, one that had come in after Lucy Olango's. That other call, about a stranger dancing at a boys and girls club, turned out to be minor. And the records make no mention of a mental health issue. While Lucy Olango had told dispatchers twice that her brother was having a mental breakdown. We showed the logs to Lucy's lawyer, Dan Gillion.
It was a big mistake in not sending that PERT team to this call because they had every evidence needed that this was the call that required the PERT team.
Could it have changed the outcome for Alfred Olango?
I think that PERT team could have actually calmed down not just Alfred Olango. It might have calmed down Richard Gonzalez. It might have said to Alfred Olango, here, we're here to help. And it might have said to Richard Gonzalez, the officer, no cowboy's not needed here. We've got this under control. We know how to deal with people with mental illness.
The city confirmed that the PAT team never was sent on the Olango call. It did arrive later in response to police radio reports, but by then it was too late.
After they shot and killed my brother, I'm crying desperately. There, nobody even consoling me. The PAT team come after they kill my brother. I'm like, what are you doing here for? Oh, because the PAT team were responding to other matters or other urgent. So my brother wasn't urgent. I know probably they don't have enough team to go around, but they could have at least find at least one person that could do crisis communication with him.
We asked the city of El Cajon whether dispatchers sent the PAT team to the wrong call. In a written response, the city's attorney said the dispatch logs, quote, speak for themselves, unquote. Since the shooting, family members have created the Alfred Olango Foundation with a goal of addressing issues Alfred cared about.
And I understood his vision of the world and what he thought about and how he felt about it. And sometimes he just talked to me about homeless issues out of nowhere. And how he felt about it, what he thought about it. So I'm going to basically make sure that the foundation is designed around that. And I definitely want to tackle procedural issues policing-wise to make sure that there's a halt to all these shootings that are going on, some sort of a change that is better for people so that people don't have to suffer like this.
In response to our questions, El Cajon officials said no dispatch procedures had changed as a result of Alfred Olango's shooting. For her part, Lucy Olango still struggles to make sense of all that happened and how the system failed her brother.
What do we learn when you're in school, little kids? 2 year old, you know, like 5 or 6. Something happened. What do? Call 911. Things have changed a lot. When I called, I was hoping that they'll help him, take him to the hospital, and he could come home.
Home is now an unmarked grave.
But no, he's not going to come home. He never did.
Before pausing for a shorter break, we want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming live on Facebook. To watch our show, just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa, and don't forget to share it with your friends. We are on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Police Shootings, and we'll air some of your comments later in the show. In a moment, we'll return to discuss the Alfred Olango case. But first, let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, political tensions simmer in Kenya as opposition leader Raila Odinga takes a symbolic presidential oath of office as the people's president, despite warnings from the nation's attorney general, who called the mock swearing-in of Odinga an act of treason. An in-depth look at Kenya's political future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Joining us here are three distinguished guests: Kenya A. Bennett, Legislative Council, American Civil Liberties Union; Scott Davis, Officer and Coordinator of the Crisis Intervention Team with the Montgomery County, Maryland Police Department; and my colleague, Paul Ndiho, a multimedia journalist. Well, I have to say, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now, Paul, you happen to have, the privilege, really, of being on that great reporting team. What was the experience like? And at the end of the day, really, what lessons did you learn from that experience?
Thank you, Shaka. First of all, it was a remarkable experience going through this, talking to different people, especially family members, friends, relatives who knew him, talking to the police, in some cases filing for public records. We put in what they call FOIAs, or Freedom of Information Act, looking for these public documents. So on my behalf, I think it was a very, very profound journey for me. And even to the people who accompanied me, it was a great experience for us dealing with this kind of sensitive subject.
Well, you hear, of course, the narrator repeatedly giving the impression that this is a shooting, perhaps, that in fact could have been prevented. Did you find any empirical evidence or incontrovertible evidence to that effect?
He could not be further from the truth, from the facts, the evidence that we were able to come across. It looks like if the dispatchers or if the police had sent the right team to the location, Alfred Olango would still be alive. What happened, I think, was tragic in a sense that they sent the wrong people on the location who are inept at doing the job. If they had sent a patrol team that is, quote-unquote, in California, they have a code called 5150. So when somebody calls in, they make a call called, it's considered as an emergency or somebody dealing with mental distress or psychiatric problems. So if they had sent a team that is trained to handle such people, somebody who can de-escalate the situation, not escalate the situation, I think would be talking about a different story.
Scott, you are a professional police officer. You have watched the documentary. You have listened and what have you. Is this a case that somewhat could have turned out differently?
It's difficult sometimes to say what could have turned out differently because of the dynamics of the case, usually. Oftentimes we go on these calls, and in Montgomery County off answers probably well over 6,000 calls for mental health services a year. Mm. And we're a county with approximately 1 million people that live in the county and about 500,000 commuters. So we're interacting with persons with mental illness daily. So each case is different. No two cases are alike. It's very difficult to say. Having the training and having a CIT background or a crisis intervention team background really is an additional tool on the officer's belt to help the officer come on scene, make a quick assessment, try to determine the best course of action, and obviously de-escalate things a little bit. Very difficult to do because, as you saw in the video, sometimes you have seconds to make that decision. Very difficult at times.
What about in this particular case where you have a relative, a sister, actually calling for help? Mm-hmm. This is the kind of help that Olango ends up getting. In fact, it becomes a death kind of squad, really.
Sure. I could tell you that when I sit in roll call with other patrol officers every day, and there's thousands of roll calls in every department across the nation at every shift change, and the shift supervisors and the watch commanders will go over pertinent events that happen. Mm-hmm. They'll do some minor training stuff, and they'll highlight some important cases that are going on. I've never met a patrol officer or any police officer, for that matter, that has sat in roll call and say, hey, I hope I go out there and shoot somebody today. I hope I go out there and kill somebody today. It's bad enough that a police officer is put in a situation where that officer may or may not have to use deadly force. It's even worse, on hindsight, when this event is over, that you find out that individual had some type of developmental disability, some type of mental illness. It's debilitating. It destroys your morale. I mean, it's like, wow. There are dozens of cases that I've been on personally where we've done everything correctly and we've still had to use some level of force. And unfortunately, that's just the nature of the business at times. You try to mitigate that. You try to put factors in place to try to make sure that the individuals, number one, don't mm-hmm. have the opportunity to use a weapon, or you try to get behind barriers, cover, stuff like that. Different types of tactics that you could use to try to mitigate that. But it's very difficult, very dynamic.
There are people who would say that when you look at countries in the industrial world, there are only two countries, frankly, that where the police basically uses live bullets in those types of situations. We're talking about the United States and South Africa, for that matter, especially because of apartheid, its history of apartheid. Mm. Any particular reason why police, in those types of circumstances, do not actually use rubber bullets?
Right. Rubber bullets in some cases are used for specialty teams. Our SWAT team in Montgomery County has the availability of using that force. There's a lot of different force options that are available when you come on the scene of these of these dynamic incidents. America is in some cases a different culture, obviously, than the rest of the world. Certain countries, it's alcohol and knives. For like England, for instance, vast majority of their officers there, the vast majority of their patrol officers deal with persons that are intoxicated and have knives. America, it's guns and drugs. So unfortunately, we associate drugs and guns together. Mm. So when we come on these scenes, officers have to be armed appropriately. They have the correct protective instruments, if you will, on their belts. That includes pepper spray. That includes a baton. I carry a taser. I have deadly force. A lot of officers have shotguns, patrol rifles, and four assault rifles in their cars because of the terrorist threat, because of the active shooter threat. So you're responding to the call with a whole trunkload of carload full of protective instruments. And we have to try to make that decision what to use at that time. What is the most appropriate thing to use at that time? Do I need to up this? Do I need to down this? A lot of cases when we have barricade situations and stuff like that, we do have the availability, our SWAT team, our specialty teams do have 37 millimeter projectile munitions. They have tear gas, they have smoke, they have rubber bullets, pepper ball. They have a wide array of options to use on there. But usually in that type of situation, the situation is contained and we try to negotiate. We will always try to negotiate and contain before we do any major escalation of force.
And what about some who might say, wait a minute, yes, we do understand that you have to use live ammunition. Mm-hmm. But why do you particularly have to point at the bull, really? I was once a soldier myself, and so I know exactly what it is. Why not shoot to disable? Why shoot to kill?
Right. We hear this question a lot in law enforcement all across the country. It's very difficult when you're in a stress-induced response to able to kind of fine-tune that aiming point to a small object. If you aim at my arm and I'm moving around, I'm floating around, it's going to be very difficult to try to aim correctly and disable me. Mm. Officers, at least in our department, are trained to shoot center of mass. We try to hit the biggest object with the smallest projectile, i.e. a bullet. So we will try to disable that threat. It's very difficult when you're in a stress-induced situation where you have to think very quickly and you have to try to get, you know, the force downrange or down onto the object and stop the threat. It's very difficult to try to fine-tune that and say, okay, well, I'll try to shoot him in the toe or the leg or the arm or something like that. It's virtually impossible. And a surprisingly amount of officers nationwide, when they're put in that stressful environment, they could be crack shots in a very controlled environment. I go to an indoor range, I go to a controlled environment, and I'm shooting at a target that doesn't move, a target that's not yelling at me. And now I'm in a situation where I'm out in a different environment that I'm not used to. I have someone yelling at me, I have bystanders yelling, I have sirens, I have a lot more yelling and screaming, and the radio is talking to me, my lapel mic is talking to me, and I have to make the decision in a split second. So you try to use the appropriate amount of force to disable a threat.
Interesting. Kenya, you are a lawyer. You also happen to be, of course, working with, the American Civil Liberties Union, which, of course, is always right there in the front line for a lot of victims. In this particular case, do you think that such shooting could probably have been, in fact, prevented?
First, I want to thank you, Shaka, and Paul, and the Alongo family for really bringing attention to this issue. As I'm sure you know, this country has been engaged in dialogue and discourse over the last few years around fatal police shootings. And the documentary showed, I believe you said in your opening remarks, that there are 1,000 fatal police shootings every year, and that is just too many. One is just too many. In this particular situation, absolutely. I believe that had there been the crisis intervention training, this emphasis on de-escalation with someone who was experiencing a mental health crisis at the moment, that the situation could have turned out differently. And I think that that's the case in a lot of these fatal shootings. We know that one-third to one-half of those shootings every year involve people in mental distress. And Scott talked about this trunk full of tools that law enforcement have at their disposal. And ideally, in their disposal is this crisis intervention training, this focus on the preservation of life when encountering someone in this situation that is used first, that is the go-to, that is how we're responding to these calls to people in this time, in a time of crisis.
Now, you realize that the judgment, the ruling was that this was a case of self-defense. Was this, in your view, a case of self-defense? Was it a case, in fact, of negligence?
So as Scott was saying, it's very difficult to weigh in on the particulars of a situation. I understand that officers are making split-second decisions, and certainly I understand that it is very difficult for police. They are given a great deal of discretion in how to handle a situation, for there to be accountability, and for anyone other than the police officer to determine what happened under those circumstances and what was the appropriate response. I don't want to comment on whether or not this was, in fact, self-defense or whether this was negligence on the part of the officer. Again, I know that there's litigation surrounding this, so I do not want to comment on that specifically. But again, I do feel like a good number of these shootings can be avoided if we are focused on preserving life, if we are actually engaging as human beings and understanding that a person in a time of crisis is not going to respond well to yelling, screaming, and having a gun pointed in his or her face.
What about the issue of the police officer ordering this young man to drop the object that he was apparently holding and put his arms up? Would that necessarily give the police officer the powers of execution?
Could, possibly, but again, as we've been discussing here, the encounter between the law enforcement officer here and Alfred was wrong from the get-go. It was approached incorrectly from the start. So when you're trying to put yourself in both the officer's shoes and the victim's shoes, Alfred's shoes, and based on what we heard from the documentary, trying to understand sort of when you're in this state of distress, how it is you're going to respond. Certainly, it's not clear whether or not had Alfred dropped the item in his hand, if that would have resulted in a different outcome. It's very hard to know. Again, I hope that we start moving towards a place where we can respect life and that we have law enforcement prioritizing the preservation of it.
Now, Paul, I have been looking at various studies, and I was listening also watching the documentary. There seems to be the conclusion that if your color, the color of your skin is black or brown or whatever, you are more likely, for example, to end up with a George Wayne on the other end in the form of police. Did you find evidence to back up that, really? Because it seems to me that when you look at a lot of studies, that doesn't seem to be the case.
You are absolutely right. When we were reporting on this story, we looked at different sources, and we looked at different data when it comes to police shootings. There is one data that we kept going back and forth. It's the Washington Post, a very, very credible newspaper in the United States, perhaps in the world. So what they do is they compile data according to every single city in the United States. So they have police shootings of every state or every small city in the United States. And what we found out, the numbers are staggering. It was a remarkable, remarkable finding. For example, in 2016, there were 963 people who got shot by police. But out of that 963, 466 were white, 233 were black, 179 were Hispanic. You could also take it maybe to the last year, 2017. Pretty much about the same number of people killed by police, but there were more white people killed. About 457 white people were killed, and 223 people, black people, were killed.
When you talk about there are more whites who were killed, we know, of course, that the majority of people in the United States happen to be white. Are we talking about absolute numbers here, or are we looking at proportional, percentages and what have you?
No, we are looking at absolute numbers here. We are looking at the raw data. We are not talking about who is in terms of population. No, we are looking at the raw data, who got shot. And I should also maybe add that it's not just people being shot by police. Police is on the other end, too, receiving some policemen have died through these shootings. For example, in 2016, there were 64 64 police officers who died in the line of duty, and in 2017 recorded the lowest number of police officers killed. There were 44 killed in the line of duty. So it's a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. And what I found interesting is that, when it comes to reporting about this, it's a very sensitive subject. A lot of people don't want to touch it because of the racial tensions in this country. But the reality on the ground is so, couldn't be further from the truth. These shootings happen everywhere. And it's most likely that white people, black people, or Hispanics, or any other race for that matter, will get caught up in this.
Very interesting. Scott, what do you really think that needs to be done in order to help reduce, really? I mean, these staggering killings, really.
There's a lot of different things to be done. Public education is a key. A lot of times, I mean, letting people, number one, know how to interact when they, or, you know, let them know kind of how to interact around the police. What we like, certain things like when we're approaching vehicles on vehicle stops. We walk up to a car in the middle of the night with tinted windows. We don't know who's behind that glass. And oftentimes when individuals could put their hands on the wheel so we could see their hands, that de-escalates substantially, and it de-escalates our response. So we're able to kind of look at that and say, okay, this individual's got his hands up on the car. He's not an immediate threat. I could talk. We could argue all you want about the situation, and you know, in which case we could settle that up in court if it came down to that. But training on both ends. Our department is a very heavy training department. We pride ourselves on our ability to train our officers, and we have some of the best trained officers, I think, in the country. Mm. I wouldn't be there if I didn't agree with that statement. Our CIT program is a voluntary program. I feel we get a better quality officer by somebody that wants to be involved with the mentally ill community or help interact with the mentally ill community or persons with disabilities. It's a great motivator when these officers come to our training. They want to be there. They're not being forced to be there. And we're not forcing it upon them like in an academy type environment. So the academies changed a lot too. I mean, the academies, at least in Montgomery County in the state of Maryland, some academies go as long as 27 weeks. Mm. That's a lot. That's well over 6 months. And you're throwing an incredible amount of technology at these recruits. And some of these recruits are in their early 20s, 21, 22, some are even 20 years old. And you're throwing an incredible amount of technology, an incredible amount of physical training, use of force, shooting, de-escalation training. You're hitting them with a lot of stuff. And these officers, it's a very stressful environment. They have a huge expectation of having high test scores and performing and doing the right thing. Mm. So hitting them with mandatory CIT training in the academy, that's very difficult at times because they're not absorbing all that training. Kind of having training throughout their career is the best way to go. And revisiting topics that you learned in basic training or the academy is very advantageous. We do it all the time in our police department, and it reminds people, hey, let's go back to basics. Let's talk about what we learned 13 years ago or 3 years ago, whatever the case may be. And we have mandatory training topics that we cover. What are those? It's mental illness.
Let me ask you a stupid question. What is your interaction like with people who happen to look like me?
I'm sorry?
What is your interaction like when you meet people who look like me, for example, who happen to have a black skin?
You know, it's I treat everybody the same. And I'll tell you, as a police officer in Montgomery County, any person, visitor or resident of Montgomery County has that expectation. They have an expectation of when you call for 911 or you call for police service, you should get a competent, well-trained professional police officer that handles your complaint without any bias and handles your complaint effectively, investigates the crime, or gives you the resources you need. And take in mind, right, we're responding to everything from bomb plants or attempt bombings, terrorist attacks, to dogs that are loose. So we're going through the wide gambit. But the thing is, our department's very well trained because we have cultural diversity. We have interaction with them. We're a very diverse community. Our county has well over 120 languages spoken. So you can't go 10 feet in Montgomery County without interacting with somebody from a different culture. That's kind of neat. I mean, it's kind of neat. You don't get that in every county in the state of Maryland. You don't get that in every state of the union. So it's really neat to be able to interact with the cultures, and there's a good understanding. We have a community engagement section in our department. That unit goes out and engages with the community and tries to let them know, hey, this is what our mission is in the police department. This is what we're here for. And oftentimes, you know, we have situations where people of different cultures from different countries are afraid to call for police service because they're afraid of what their previous country's police force was like. ill-trained, ill-equipped, very heavy-handed, right? These are individuals, and I've been overseas in the military. I've seen other police forces and how they interact, and it's scary. I mean, they're very heavy-handed. When you have somebody, you know, from Egypt that's a police officer, shows up to your house with an AK-47, that's a bit intimidating. Mm. It would be for me.
But there's no democracy in Egypt.
Exactly.
There's a democracy in the United States.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. So I think American policing has gotten better. I think it you know, we're never going to be where we it's not going to be a perfect department, but we will always move forward and try to make it a better department.
I see.
So it's all about interacting with people and giving people the respect that you respect in return. I would never ever look at somebody's skin or where they're from and make a decision prior to assessing a call.
Getting the confidence level, the comfort level of dealing with diverse cultural groups and all that kind of stuff. Let me come to you, Kenya. What about you, Kenya? There was once a great American preacher, and his name was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He once said that he had a dream that one day his kids, his children, would not be judged by the skin, the color of their skin, but rather by the content of their character. Did he, in fact, have that dream in vain?
I hope not. I hope not, Shaka. Mm-hmm. And what you're touching on is race relations here in the United States. And I think we are still a far ways out from realizing that dream. And I think that certainly is evidenced through the dynamic between police and community. That's one of the areas in which we have seen that race relations continue to suffer in this country. You were talking about statistics earlier, and it is true that people of color, black people, are disproportionately impacted by police use of force, are often fatally shot by police. We know that black men make up about 5% of the population here in the United States, but account for about a quarter of fatal police shootings. And so, again, that demonstrates that there is tension between law enforcement and communities, and that needs to be addressed, and we need to determine how it is we go forward. In addition to crisis intervention training, we need police officers to engage in implicit bias training. Implicit bias is those stereotypes, those attitudes that all of us have, regardless of our race, our gender, that we go into a situation thinking how it is we are going to respond, how it is we are going to engage with another person. That's critical to policing and to ensuring that we are eliminating the number of individuals who are killed every year at the hands of police. I do hope the dream was not in vain. And we do have a ways to go, but I'm heartened to hear that we have law enforcement committed to a culture change on a range of issues.
Well, on that note, time happens not to be our best ally, and thanks to my three distinguished guests, Kenya A. Bennett, Officer Scott Davis, and my colleague, Paul Ndiho. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not better, beta Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.